Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Princeton University Press. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Bea Wilson, author of Swindled, The Dark History of Food Fraud, From Poisoned Candy to Counterfeit Coffee. As the book makes clear, concern about what's on our plates is nothing new. People have been worrying about adulterated bread since at least the Middle Ages, and the Victorians had to contend with fake tea, ersatz coffee, and cheese coloured with red lead. For good reason, one reviewer has called the book marvellous and horrifying. When I met Bea, I asked her about a German chemist named Frederick Achim, who did much in the early 19th century to bring to the British public's attention the ways in which they were being swindled over their food.
Achim's treatise, which was published in 1820, was really the first one to open the eyes of the British public to the extent to which practically everything that was bought and sold as food or drink was falsified or tampered with or dyed or padded or not what it seemed in some way. And the book had an electrifying impact. It was an instant bestseller. It was talked about, it was written about, and it really did shock people, even though before then people had realised that things went on, that beer was watered down and endless stories circulated about bread not being quite what it seemed. But partly because Achim was a chemist, he could say, look, this isn't just fiction, it isn't a joke. It's absolutely true, and you can do these chemical tests to show that this cream that you've bought isn't cream, it's arrowroot mixed with water. And that this tea that you think you're drinking is actually sloe leaves, which have been gathered from the English hedgerows and then elaborately curled and dried and painted green with toxic copper. So I mean, it had a fantastic impact. And I think the other thing that made it so powerful was that Achim brought to the project a kind of fierce moral indignation, partly because he came from a much more interventionist atmosphere. He was a German, he'd been brought up in Westphalia, he was used to eating really good, wholesome, properly made bread and homemade ham and really good jams. And what he saw in Britain just he found disgusting and hair-raising in all kinds of ways.
That's something which comes across very strongly in the book, that there was a marked difference between the quality of food in the United Kingdom and continental Europe. And you attribute that to a particular political, economic climate in the UK.
Yes, I mean, I think a number of factors come together. I mean, adulteration is really a universal in history. I mean, it's always been with us. It's always going to be with us in some form or another. There are always greedy people who are going to try to pull the wool over our eyes and sell us something for a higher price than it should be, or something that's not quite what it seems. But it only seems to have become endemic in modern industrialised cities, coupled with a particular kind of state. And I mean, we all know that Britain in the 1820s was very laissez-faire, and you would actually have editorials being written in the Times between the 1820s and about the 1860s quite regularly saying things like, well, if a gentleman wants to sell chicory and call it coffee, that's his business and no one should intervene, and you know, it's nobody else's business but his. And so I think it was the combination of these vast industrialized cities which made food kind of spiral out of control. You get these huge chains, which hadn't existed before, between consumer and producer, with many more hands that the food is passing through, many more opportunities for dishonesty, coupled with a sort of politics, a sort of government that wasn't really prepared to intervene to stop it.
Although Achim had a big impact on public consciousness of adulteration, there doesn't seem to have been much impact in terms of legislation. That seemed to have to wait until Arthur Hill Hassel came along in the 1850s with his microscope.
Yeah, that's the surprising thing. I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for that. Part of it was that the very same year that Achim's book was published, he suffered a total personal disgrace. He was witnessed tearing pages from books in the Library of the Royal Institution, and he fled the country. He went back to Germany and never came back to England, never got over the shame of it. And so I think if he had stayed in the country, he would have continued to campaign and maybe something would have happened. But also, there was a sense that really the political establishment wasn't going to do anything at that point. Whereas in the 1850s, when Arthur Hill Hassel came along, the climate was much more receptive to the idea, this has gone on long enough, we've got to do something. But the other really powerful thing, as you've said, that Hassel had at his disposal was the microscope. And it's really weird in a way, because after all, the microscope had been around for centuries by this point. And I still find it slightly puzzling thinking, why had nobody really thought of putting food under the microscope before? But it was partly, a lot of serious scientists saw the microscope as just a kind of silly toy, I think. It was chemistry, certainly at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, that had all of the prestige. And the microscope was just seen as a sort of hobby for gentlemen almost. And indeed, in Arthur Hill Hassall's case, it was his hobby. He was a very nervous doctor who had a practice in Notting Hill. And he took very early retirement because of his nerves. And he had to occupy himself in some way. And he kept reading all these references in the paper that sometimes coffee wasn't real coffee. And he was someone with a bit like with Ackham. He had a deep sense of honesty and how disgraceful it was to tell lies about food. And he just decided off his own bat to go around London buying samples of coffee, putting them under the microscope and seeing if they really were coffee. And he found out that in the vast majority of cases that they weren't, that they were chicory if you were lucky, or ground up burnt peas and beans and burnt flour and mangel wurzel and all kinds of nasty things. And it was when Hassall then joined up with this man, Thomas Wakeley, who was the founder of The Lancet, that together the pair of them created probably the most powerful exercise in publicity against bad food that's ever been mounted. And Wakeley gave Hassall this room in The Lancet once a week and then once a fortnight to expose different foodstuffs. And absolutely systematically, they just went through one by one, buying up every pickle on the market in London, every piece of mustard, every cinnamon stick, and putting them under the microscope and saying, are these really what they say they are? And all too often they weren't.
And legislation followed in due course so that the demon grocer became a figure of the past, except that the demon grocer persisted in popular imagination well into the 20th century, didn't it?
Yes. I mean, G.K. Chesterton's famous poem about the demon grocer was, I think, 1904, by which point, actually, most of what was being sold in grocer's shops in England was perfectly fine. But I think it exemplifies this point that these myths about bad food, these myths about swindling, often persist long after the food supply has been cleaned up. And, I mean, it's so much a question of trust. Even after people factually can trust food, they still don't feel as if they can trust it. And these feelings shouldn't be discounted because I think they affect the way that people behave. Often when you feel you can't trust food, you want to put your faith in something. And what people put their faith in a lot at the start of the 20th century was packaged foods, because packaged, branded, processed foods suddenly seemed wonderfully safe and controlled compared to the messy, risk-filled food from that came straight from the farm.
Now, the story in the United States is similar but different, not least in the tone in which the debate is conducted, because in the UK it's a sort of debate of science and it's conducted in the pages of The Lancet on parliamentary inquiries. Can you say something about how the anti-adulteration debate was carried out in the United States?
It was much more evangelical, much more religious. And it reached a kind of higher pitch on both sides of intensity. And there were these fierce battles. For example, one of the most famous ones was between the margarine manufacturers and the butter manufacturers. And the butter manufacturers wouldn't just say, we don't want people to sell margarine, or oleo, as they called it. Oleo margarine was the name for it in the States. We don't want people to sell oleo and call it butter. And that would be a sort of perfectly fair position that anyone would be able to agree with. They would say, we don't want them to sell it at all. The Lord God, our creator, has given the colour yellow to butter alone. So if they're going to make this thing margarine and dye it yellow, they're automatically deceiving people. So laws were passed in several states of the United States requiring that all margarine be dyed pink in order that no one could possibly be deceived by it. And I think that's a sign of things were really cranked up to an extra level in the States. It was kind of vehemence, both of the adulterators and the anti-adulterators.
And it's also an example of something which was considered an illegitimate, bastardised food when it came along and is now taken entirely for granted. And I think it's interesting in your book how some things have gone from being acceptable to unacceptable and other things have gone in the opposite direction.
Yes, I do find that really interesting. And yes, I mean, lots of things that are on the shelves now would seem to Ackham to be absolutely non-foods. I mean, he gets very worked up about lemonade, which isn't made from real lemons. Well, if you saw the average bottle of what's called fizzy lemonade in Britain, he'd be appalled that it's mainly made from citric acid and sugar and a bit of sweetener. And that certainly is not lemonade by his standards. But on the other hand, some things, I mean, wine is the classic example, have become much purer and better than they ever were at any previous period of history. Partly because in order to do something about adulteration, you have to know what the good food should be in the first place. And until very recently, winemaking was such an imprecise art, people didn't really know what good wine should be. Whereas I think with bread, the opposite has happened. In the Middle Ages, and well, in France and Germany as recently as the 18th century, people knew absolutely what bread should be. Whereas now, if you look in the average British or American supermarket, anything that is made from flour and water and God knows what else is allowed to call itself bread, even if it hasn't been proved, it hasn't really been needed. And our ancestors would have been pretty shocked by that.
So back in the early Victorian period, the attitude was caveat emptor. Mm. And since then, we've had lots of legislation and food standards authorities and so on. But do you think it's really changed? That doesn't really take away the individual's requirement to understand what's in food and what constitutes good food versus bad food, because those agencies, it seems to me, are concerned perhaps with short-term health, but not with longer-term nutrition and so on.
I think that's right, yes. I mean, I think we do largely live in a caveat venditor society now. I mean, the sellers should beware. Food producers are always complaining about how they're tied up in this endless red tape. And I think the supermarkets, much as we might complain about them, have been very good for basic food hygiene, food safety. They don't want to make us ill if they can help it in the short term, as you say. But the long term is an altogether different thing. And I think modern governments, as with 19th century governments, have been very timid about intervening or the extent to which they intervene. And I mean, there've been constant recent cases in the paper where additives which had been cleared as safe are then taken out of the food supply, which makes you wonder why they were allowed in the food supply in the first place. But I still think we're tremendously lucky compared to societies which are still genuine caveat emptor ones, such as modern day Bangladesh, where in the markets of Dhaka, it is said that adulteration is still fundamentally the rule rather than the exception. And you have these cases of kind of cooking oil contaminated with sewage and rancid old coconuts being sold as fresh ones, which is a very old trick. That goes back to the markets of Manchester in the 1840s. And fruits which were artificially ripened with poisonous carbides. I mean, really dreadful things happening. Or modern day China, which to me very much resembles the early capitalist cities of early Victorian England, for the combination of this restless capitalism coupled with a state which doesn't really want to do anything about it. And one of the most horrifying stories in China was the fake baby milk scandal of 2004, when it was a really large-scale industrial operation. People were systematically making this fake stuff, which was little but sugar and starch, marketing it to peasant families who could ill afford to buy it, the result being that the babies died. Well, it doesn't get much worse than that. And cases like that don't happen in Britain anymore.
You talk in the American context about the Food Standards Agency trying to originally establish what was a legitimate recipe for certain foodstuffs. And you mention what we would call jam and what would be called jelly in America. And they laid down a percentage of fruit to a percentage of sugar. But by the 60s, you say they had stopped the recipe-based approach to food because there were so many new foodstuffs coming along with brand names that didn't really approximate any existing foodstuffs. And at that point, do you think that's a critical point when control really goes wholeheartedly into the hands of the manufacturers to create new fake foods or what you might call it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's in 1973 when they finally abandoned, it was the 1938 Food and Drugs Act, which had tried to set these recipe-based standards, but it already probably had galloped out of control. Because as you say, yes, it's very easy to set a recipe for something like jam, which is simply fruit and sugar in a certain ratio. And you simply set the ratio and say legally, there must be this amount of sugar and no more, and a minimum of this amount of fruit. Fine. But if you've got some product like, I don't know, kind of fake cheese whiz, or kind of tubes of fake fromage frais or an artificial kind of rehydrated trifle. Where do you start? There's no tradition for a product like that, which you might think, well, in previous times, governments might have said, well, if there's no tradition for it, then it can't be food, so we're not going to allow it. Whereas, of course, now it would be impossible. The floodgates have opened. So since there is no tradition for it, this phrase came into use that manufacturers were allowed to use any ingredients which were safe and suitable. So they could say anything was safe and suitable, any amount of oil, any amount of sugar, any amount of colourings and sweeteners and flavourings. They just say, well, this is how we make it. It's safe and suitable. And it was the consumer, as always, who lost out.
So when you look in people's supermarket trolleys, do you feel a sense of despair or loss of hope that when you see the synthetic, manufactured, processed fake foods that people are buying?
No, I don't think everyone's buying food like that. I mean, the thing I feel a true despair about is I think there's just a huge dichotomy now between people who cook and people who don't cook. I think if you basically cook most of your food from scratch on a pretty regular basis, you're going to be fine. Whereas if you have totally forgotten how to cook or never knew how to do it in the first place, then you're absolutely not going to be fine. And that gap just seems to get wider and wider. And that's why, in a way, I think this concept of adulteration is quite a useful one to bring to food. Because sometimes gourmets and food writers take their discussions of food to such an elevated level, these endless, minute discussions of the authenticity of a particular type of tortelloni, whereas it's sometimes quite useful just to get back to basics and say, well, is this a real piece of broccoli? Is this a real chicken? Is this a real loaf of bread? And I mean, often the answer is no, but these are good questions to ask.
It's quite telling. In the book, you talk about vanilla versus vanillin, which is one of the chemical substances found in vanilla. And you say that people often prefer vanillin to genuine vanilla because they're used to it. Now, vanilla may not have a high nutritional, you know, contribution to our diets, but do you see a problem there that people have simply no context in which to judge whether a food is a good food or a bad food?
I see a huge problem there. I think that's where the biggest problem is. I think there's a danger that people who have never been exposed to proper, real food will not merely not know what to make of it when they do encounter it, they will actually be repulsed by it. I mean, there have been studies done showing people, the majority of people, prefer the taste of vanillin to the taste of vanilla. Well, and that might sound a sort of pointless, snobby, foodish example to take, but when you extend that to somebody preferring, for example, artificial raspberry taste to a real raspberry, that has real nutritional impact on their diet. And if a child, for example, has eaten raspberry flavour yogurt with no raspberry in it, but never a real raspberry, it's going to make a big difference to them.
I was saying that on the way here, I bought a drink which turned out not to be a genuine fruit juice, but actually a fruit drink which contained sugar and water. So caveat emptor didn't apply in my case. But what would be your sort of tips for people who are going out and hoping to avoid the fake foods and being swindled?
I think the biggest thing you do is just get back to raw ingredients. If you're basically buying fresh eggs, fresh butter, real oil, although there have been plenty of cases of olive oil adulteration lately in Italy, it's big business, but still, oil from somebody you trust. Just basic fruit and vegetables. You can't go far wrong. And yes, you may occasionally be sold something that isn't quite as good as it might be. But if on the whole you're eating real food, that makes a much bigger difference than... I mean, I think the other thing that this story has taught me is that another danger is in people who get so obsessed with the purity of food that they lose sight of what good food really is. And this happened to various of the campaigners that I write about in the book. It happened, sadly, to Arthur Hill Hassell at the end of his life. He got so fixated with purity and the idea that there was deceit and sort of terribleness everywhere in food that he tried to set up this thing called the Pure Food Company, which he was going to sell, which was going to sell people nothing but the absolute purest food. Very pure, but unfortunately totally horrible sounding things like pure fibrinous meat lozenges. And we can think of all kinds of modern day equivalents. People who get so terrified by food that they feel that they need to buy food supplements, for example. Or people who just feel nothing is safe if it hasn't got the organic label on it. And I like organic food, but I think you have to take it all with a pinch of salt and Don't forget common sense.
I was talking to B. Wilson about Swindled, the dark history of food fraud, from poisoned candy to counterfeit coffee, which is available now. Thank you for listening to this download from Princeton University Press. And until next time, goodbye.